with Professor Jaime Luch from the University of Puerto Rico. Professor, welcome to McGill.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I hope you enjoy your time here, even though, as you might see, it's like the weather is not very good. But
not very good. It seems going to
Exactly. Rain. So in preparation for this interview, I have read some of the reviews for your book.
Yes.
And in one of them, it says that your book examines, so Visions of Sovereignty examines, why some nationalists adopt a secessionist stance,
right,
while others within the same national movement choose a non-secessionist constitutional orientation.
Right.
So some are for secession and others are against secession.
Right. Yeah, it's the different orientations that sub-state national parties tend to adopt. And what's interesting is that throughout the world, they're similar. Because you have Corsica, you have Flanders, you have the Euskadi, País Vasco, you have Puerto Rico, many different places, and you have a similar party system in some of these, in many of these places.
So it's the same phenomenon that is reproduced.
Exactly, yeah. It's the same phenomenon. It's the condition of being a stateless nation. It's the condition of being a national minority, which is very different from being France. France has its sovereignty and it's been
exactly.
for over 200 years. Places like the Basque Country or like Catalonia or Quebec often have a national movement, which in to some extent is seeking the affirmation of the nation, but there are several orientations possible. Independence, autonomism, or federalism.
All right. So each state has its own particular features, but it's the same phenomenon being reproduced in different parts of the
right.
world.
And that's why it makes me think that we're talking about the same phenomenon.
Exactly. It's interesting, right? To
right.
To think about how they can interconnect in different ways and intersect.
Right.
So in Scott Boykin's book, The Ethics of Secession, he says that one of the fundamental questions of political philosophy has been the basis of the state's authority. So what do you think, or what would you say is the role of the state when facing a secession? How does the state respond?
Yeah, that's always a difficult constitutional issue.
Yeah.
But part of what I think I'm saying in this book and elsewhere in other articles is the importance of having a state that is willing to be pluralistic in its approach to its national minorities, that is willing to reciprocate, that is willing to offer dignity to those sub-state nations, and above all, a form of constitutional accommodation, a form of civic discourse that can accommodate these peculiar sub-state national societies.
Right, so would you say you support the idea of multiculturalism in countries? Or
right.
you believe rather that we should have a monocultural kind of nation state?
I prefer to use the word pluralistic, plural national, pluralist,
okay.
Plural federalism, pluralistic federalism,
yeah.
Multinational federalism, because when we talk about multiculturalism, I think we're talking about ethnic groups and racial groups.
Yeah.
And to be more precise, in the case of sub-state nations such as Corsica or Flanders
exactly,
or
yeah.
Scotland,
yeah.
you're talking about a different phenomenon. These are places that have institutionally developed as nations for many centuries, and their needs are different. So it's better to use the term multinational accommodation.
The idea of pluralism.
Territorial pluralism,
okay.
territorial pluralism, etc.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the, or I guess like one of like the main argument of your book, Visions of Sovereignty, is the fact that you put forth this idea of the moral polity thesis.
Right, yeah.
So could you explain to me what that is about?
Well, that is the one of the central arguments in the book, or perhaps the central argument.
Yeah.
And this the notion, the idea is that sub-state nationalists perceive themselves to be in a moral polity, perceive themselves to be in a state where they have expectations of reciprocity, dignity, respect, pluralism, tolerance, and constitutional accommodation. So they perceive themselves to be in a state that should be reciprocating, that should be offering pluralism. Whenever those sub-state nationalists perceive that the central state has not been complying with this expectation, there's a sense of moral deception, a moral disappointment. And that often leads to their radicalization towards options such as independentism or radical autonomism to some extent. So that what motivates radicalization in national is not economics, and it's not culture or language, because these are all equally national. It's more this political factor of perceiving non-reciprocity by a central state. So it is a political factor that explains the general movement towards more radical stances vis-a-vis the central state.
Right. Face-to-face to that situation. So could you say it is a matter of disengagement or a lack of reciprocity mainly between the central state and the sub-state that you talk about that triggers this phenomenon?
Well, it could be many things. I mean, many phenomena. But it could be many, many things. But I think in general, there tend to be constitutional developments. Something is happening constitutionally that triggers this moral disappointment. And so we have to be attentive to constitutional moments. Constitutional moments are key moments, such as the adoption of a new statute of autonomy, the adoption, the amendment to a constitution, the proposal to put forward amendments and all that. So I think we need to focus on constitutional phenomena.
Right.
And constitutional changes that trigger this kind, that could possibly trigger this kind of moral disappointment.
In the subset nationalists.
In the subset nationalists, right.
Okay. So one of the arguments you pursue in your book is this idea that what you're doing basically is like shattering this dualism of thinking of this phenomenon as rather, you know, presenting nationalist visions of sovereignty as either secessionist or non-secessionist.
That's exactly right. I think there's a lack of understanding in the literature and in people that study nationalism. Nationalism is not just about independence versus non-independence, but it's about different stances that sub-state nationalists can take. And it just so happens that all of them are nationalists, essentially.
Yeah.
And but they have different preferences. Some are federalists, and there are several types of federalists. Some are autonomists, and there are several types of autonomists. And some are independent, but even within the independentist camp, there are differences. There are Souveraineté Association, the Parti Québécois for some time, República Asociada in the case of some other places, and then there's pure independence. You know, so there's gradations, and it's a lot more complicated than it seems.
Right, exactly. So you have conducted a lot of thorough qualitative field research in both Catalonia and Quebec. You have spoken with the main political leaders. You have engaged in focus groups with base-level militants. You have distributed questionnaires, etc.
Right.
So what was your research like?
Well, it was thanks to funding from the Ford Foundation. 3 years of support plus another year at the end, 4 years in total. I was liberated from being in New Haven, Connecticut, where Yale University is. And I could really consider spending time doing real field work in two places. Mostly this was Barcelona and Montreal. And so it was challenging. It was somewhat frustrating at the beginning. But somehow I think I was successful, I guess, mainly due to my own perseverance and obtuseness.
Yeah.
I think it's not easy, but look, I enjoyed it in the end because I spent a lot of time in Barcelona and Montreal, and both are nice cities, except the weather here. but they're overall nice and, you know, democratic places. This is not the situation in Iraq or Chechnya. These are more manageable, you know, you have less tension, less violence, or you have no violence back then. So it was difficult, but I was able to, I think, to do it well at the end.
Yeah. And in your opinion, what are the prospects, like your expectations for secessionist movements in Catalonia and Quebec?
Well, that's why in part, I suppose, why I'm here in part. When I started this work back in 2001, the independentist case seemed to be Quebec.
Yeah.
The really worrisome case, you might say, was Quebec. And Catalonia was interesting because it was happily autonomous, and which is puzzling by itself.
Mm-hmm.
But time has passed, and they've exchanged places. As everybody knows, in the last 7 years or so, the Catalan case has grown dramatically in its pro-independence orientation, and this is part of what provokes a crisis in Spain. And in fact, I think everybody agrees this is the biggest political problem that Spain has had in many years, and maybe in the last 10 years for sure. And so the situation is completely unfolding. There are new events every day or every week. So it's hard to, literally every day there's something new happening there. But they have a major problem. I would advise the Madrid government to think of my thesis,
yeah,
and to offer constitutional forms of accommodation that quiet down, that lower the level of unhappiness and moral disappointment,
yeah, exactly,
of the sub-state nationalists in Catalonia. Because otherwise, I mean, how long is this going to go on? And how many more people in prison? Or this kind of event like we saw like last October 1st, people,
yeah,
being clubbed by policemen. That'll be my advice for the government in Madrid.
Yeah, and it's actually very interesting, right? Because like those independentist like movement, like sentiments are still there. And so what you say is like, it's right because we like the state, what it should do is to quiet down basically, but it will still be
that's,
there.
That's a moral quality argument. You
yeah.
know, it's a intersubjective relations of reciprocity.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that'll be my advice to I mean, that's what David Cameron and Alex Salmond agreed in Scotland 5 years ago or so. And they sat down, they laid out a referendum, and it worked out fine for the UK. And for now, that problem has subsided.
Yeah, for the time being. Sometimes I think it's really useful to go back to the humanities in some of this. Particularly to philosophy, when we talk about political philosophy and morality cases in particular. So I found a quote by one of the greatest philosophers, in my opinion, Karl Popper, liberal philosophers. And he wrote a book called The Open Society and Its Enemies, in which he says that civilization has not yet fully recovered from the shock of its birth, the transition from the tribal or enclosed society with its submission to magical forces, to the open society, which sets free the critical powers of man.
Yeah.
It attempts to show that the shock of this transition is one of the factors that have made possible the rise of those reactionary movements which have tried and still try to overthrow civilization and to return to tribalism. So I know it's quite long, but don't you think that's a very good argument for a phenomenon like this?
Here's the thing. At least the cases I have been working on, not only Quebec and Catalonia, but other cases like in northern Italy. I'm a little afraid of using this word tribalism because I don't think these nationalism that I have been looking at are civic nationalisms. They're democratic. They're nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
They are liberal nationalism in the style of Will Kimlicka or Yael Tamir, other philosophers. You probably know them, Charles Taylor himself. And I think they truly are. They're not reactionary or tribal. They're just, I mean, every nation state is nationalist. You know, the U.S., Canada, France, Italy, Japan, they have their nationalism. So does Catalonia. So does the Basque Country. And it's, believe me, I mean, take the example of the recent Olympics. If you see the way they cover it in NBC in the U.S., it's completely nationalist.
Yeah,
and it's even ethnic in many ways, and
populist.
So I don't think what they're doing in Catalonia is tribalist or primordialist. They're just trying to be themselves, and I think that's fine. Everybody has a right to be themselves, himself or herself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what do you think about this idea that, you know, diversity in general, which is in a way related to this problem, like diversity in a society. So it is a phenomenon that exists, that takes place, but not something that should be encouraged. Like, do you think we should have a multicultural or multi-ethnic, I don't know, kind of education? Like this open-minded
education? Well, I think what the Canadian model is interesting. And I mean, to encourage a multilingual, multicultural, even multinational identities is fine. In certain situations, such as the Canadian one, I think that's probably the way to go. For other countries, it's fine.
Professor, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.